Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
Hall of Fame week continues. Today, we're talking with Hall of Famer Mike Mussina, who, among many memories, gives us a first-person account of the Derek Jeter flip play. He addresses the question of whether Oriole pitchers actually check the measurements posted on the hitter-friendly outfield fences at Camden Yards. And Taylor heard this yesterday. I asked him about pitching in the 2001 World Series and about how he broke out a pitch that he didn't usually use for Game 5 of that World Series. That was fun.
It was awesome, and it was almost, you know, it's such a cool thing that he did there, a really wild and ballsy thing, and he seems like he basically forgot about it. I could almost hear you say in the interview, like, I charted all your games, those seasons that I covered you. I could hear you, like, shuffling your papers from those charts and bringing that up, and he was like...
He was trying to downplay it, yeah. And I'm like, Moose, you broke out a new pitch in the middle of the World Series. Not really 100% as he talks about it. He tinkered with it a little bit, but that was a fun conversation.
Really good stuff there.
Slugger Mark Reynolds is retiring after hitting 298 homers over 13 seasons with 8 teams. He made that announcement last week on Sirius XM Radio. I wanted to mention it today because he has been one of baseball's really good guys. When the free agent was asked whether he's still pursuing a new team, Reynolds said he has moved beyond that. I've retired. He added that he's enjoying spending time with his family, and it's time for him to find something else to do. And knowing Mark, he'll definitely do that. After the Milwaukee Brewers announced last month they'd be establishing a $1 million fund to provide financial assistance to Miller Park game day employees whose jobs have been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic, some of the team's most familiar faces are stepping up to the plate to help as well. Ryan Braun was the first to commit with a $100,000 contribution to the initial $1 million fund. And Bob Uecker has followed suit with $50,000 the team announced on Monday. Now, before we get to the interview with Mike Mussina, I want to give you a heads up. The College Football Podcast has emerged from hibernation and dropped a new episode. Kevin Negandhi is talking NFL draft with Todd McShay. Todd highlights the two things all NFL teams are most worried about, the latest on the quarterback class, and his relationship with Mel Kiper Jr. Find it now wherever you get your podcast. And before we get to Moose, here's Tim Kirkchin's baseball fix about another Hall of Fame pitcher, Nolan Ryan.
Hi, this is Tim Kirkchin. On this date in 1968, Nolan Ryan won his first major league game. He won 324 games. He struck out almost 900 more batters than anyone in the history of the game. He threw 7 no-hitters. He's the greatest power pitcher in the history of baseball. He's the hardest pitcher to hit in the history of baseball. And he threw a baseball as hard as any man alive for 25 years. And through it all, he was loved by teammates and even some guys on the other team. Rance Mullinix, the third baseman for the Blue Jays, was once asked, "What would life be if everyone was like Nolan Ryan?" And he said, "Everyone would love each other and no one would get a hit." So 10 years ago, Ryan, at age 63, threw out the ceremonial first ball at a Rangers game. His catcher was Jim Sundberg, a 6-time Gold Glover. Ryan walked to the top of the mound, and the first pitch was thrown at 85 miles an hour. And Sundberg told me, "I wasn't ready for that. I had to crouch down real fast just to catch it, and I split my pants."
Mike Mussina was inducted into Baseball's Hall of Fame last year with 270 career wins. And Moose, when I contacted you last week, you mentioned to me that you invented social distancing, which I had laughed. That is 100% true.
Well, I don't know if it's 100% true, but it's a lot. It's kind of easy. I don't know. This whole situation isn't very easy, but for the adjustments that I had to make with it, it's really not that difficult to stay home and stay out of the way and just go from one day to the next. And with what's going on, you know, hopefully we'll just get through this as soon as we can.
And I appreciate you joining us to create at least a little bit of a distraction for folks. Yeah, when I first covered you with the Baltimore Sun in 1995, I asked you, and I don't know if you remember this, but I asked you what you were going to do and at the end of your career. And at that time, you're only, 4 years into it, 4 or 5 years into it. And your answer was, I'm going to retire. I'm going to go back to my hometown. I'm going to live in a house there, and I'm going to coach. And that's exactly what took place. You know, unlike a lot of your peers, you didn't go to the coast in Florida or some island someplace or out in California. You're back in Montoursville, up on a mountaintop.
Well, I didn't know I was that accurate back then, but that's kind of how it turned out. I still lived back here in the off season, so I got kind of two different worlds: the working world for, you know, a 9-month season, and then the relaxed get away from it world for 3 months. So I just, you know, and I had just started getting back into coaching in the off season at that time back in 95. So I kind of figured that's what I wanted to do for a while. I was enjoying it. And I got out of coaching in the off season, when I got married for about 12 or 13 years, maybe a little longer than that. And then I got back into it again when my boys got old enough to start getting involved, and I wasn't playing anymore. So I got back into it. And now I've been doing that ever since I retired. And this is, if the season would have started, this would have been my 12th. You know, I've been out for 11 years, so this is the beginning of the 12th year that I wouldn't be playing. So it's been a while.
Tell me what you love about coaching.
Well, I just, you know, it's something that I can be involved in with my children and working with the kids and helping them deal with success and deal with adversity and understand that you know, if you want something that's important to you, you know, you're going to have to work for it. It's not going to be handed to you. You know, it's not supposed to be easy if it's worthwhile. So we just kind of keep plowing through it every day. And I've been fortunate the last few years. I've had good players and they've been doing it long enough with our system that they understand that that's how it works. And we've done well the last few years. I've been the high school varsity coach for seven. We just finished our seventh year before all this insanity happened. So, but it's been great. I've enjoyed it. You know, I help with the baseball team in the spring, and I do golf in the fall, which is a fall sport in Pennsylvania, because my younger son doesn't play football. He's a golfer. So, and I'm not really a coach per se, as a golf person. I'm more like a supervisor. I make sure they get where they're supposed to be, and I help them with the basic stuff, but that's about it. But I just enjoy doing it. I love getting out there, you know, trying to help, trying to, you know, be a positive influence for, you know, the couple hours a day that I have them. You know, after my younger son graduates, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to stick with it, but I don't really plan on stopping entirely, but I won't have any kids involved anymore, so it'll be a little different.
So my favorite story about you that I tell people is about is from the 2001 World Series, which I think it sort of spoke to your understanding of pitching, your understanding of yourself. In game one of the World Series that year against Arizona, as you know, the Diamondbacks got to you, especially left-handed hitters, 5 runs in 3 innings. Game five rolls around, and I had covered you with the Baltimore Sun for 2 years, and I covered you with the Yankees in 2001. I charted every one of your starts in those 3 years. So I knew your repertoire, you know, pretty well in terms of what your fastball velocity typically was, what your curveball velocity typically was, where your changeup was. And game five begins, and you could see that, like, the Diamondback hitters were struggling, left-handed hitters were struggling at some pitch that wasn't the same velocity as anything I'd ever seen you throw before. That was, you know, I think your curveball, your changeup were in the low 80s. This was like 84, 85. And after the second or third inning, I ran over to the international broadcast booth and I asked Rick Sutcliffe, hey, what is that he's throwing? And Sut goes, oh, that's his curveball. I'm like, no. And this is in the days before super slow-mo, where you could actually break down on the screen what the pitch was. And, you know, as you know, the game goes into extra innings. You guys win. And I thought about it on the flight out to Arizona. And I walked up to you before game six of the World Series. And I said, did you really break out a split finger fastball in the middle of the World Series? And you looked at me and you put a finger to your mouth and you went, shh. That was one of the more amazing things I've ever seen covering baseball, where you adapted in that situation in the way that you did.
Well, I would say, you know, since you didn't, as I first of all, as I got older, you have to do those things. That's just part of surviving, is making changes and making adjustments. I'll probably tell you, it wasn't the first time that I'd used it. It wasn't like I had just decided to,
right,
out of nowhere, throw a split just because. I had messed with it before, and some days it's better than others, and some, you know, you try it and it's coming out okay, and it's doing mostly what you want it to do. And so if, on days like that, if you can try it and it works, then maybe you use it a little bit. But it's probably just one of those situations where I felt like they had a reasonable idea what I was doing for some reason, or at least they had a good look at me the first time around. So I wanted to just maybe show something else that had to talk about it when they went back to the dugout. Like, they had to mention it. It had to be something else to think about. And, you know, maybe it was just working good enough that I said, well, wait a minute. If I show this to everybody, then it's just one more thing they got to put in their heads when they stand in the batter's box. So that's kind of probably my thought process, is the more I can make them think, the better chance I have. And that's a lot of what I did as I got older. I mean, I threw slower curveballs. I changed arm angles. I brought out, some days I had a cutter, backdoor it. You know, I did a lot of different things, just because you have to keep making adjustments and keep making them, think about more things when they step in the batter's box. If I just kept doing the old overhand fastball, overhand curve change for my entire career, then my entire career would have been a lot shorter. So it's just part of the process of surviving and going out there to get the job done any way you can.
Now, how much do you figure you threw a splitter in a game, or was that just something where when you played catch on flat ground, you just kind of messed with when you're just throwing before every game?
I probably, at that point in my career, which was about, you know, a little past halfway, I messed around with it for a couple of years. Not really in a game all that much. Maybe I'd throw one here, throw one there, just to see what it would do. I mean, when you get in a situation like that, and I had played long enough that I felt confident enough that, listen, I've got to find a way to get through this somehow. And whether it's, I can't just keep throwing fastballs. I'm not going to throw harder or anything like that. Or my curveball's not going to get better. You know, you got to do something else. So I had enough experience and maybe self-confidence or whatever. I'm just going to do this and see what it does. And so that's what I did. And so it works, you know, occasionally it works. It makes a great story when it works. If it's not working, you throw it away after about two or three of them and say, well, forget that. It's not doing anything that I want it to do. I have no idea where it's going. Forget it. So in this circumstance, it worked well enough that it became part of the story.
In that game, 8 innings and 2 runs allowed, and as they say, you guys won that game in extra innings. And you know, during your time as a pitcher, your mechanics were viewed by a lot of pitching coaches, front office people, as being close to perfect. I remember doing a story on you at the Baltimore Sun where you talked about how your mechanics were basically self-taught from your observations watching television. What do you remember about that?
I mean, I grew up in a small town. It wasn't as if, and I, you know, we're talking about the 70s and 80s. So it's not as if there's internet to watch. There's no list of coaching clinics or pitching clinics to go to. And you could watch TV. And even in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of baseball on television, certainly not like today. So when I had a chance to watch somebody that was a pretty good player, I just tried to watch and imitate what I saw. So that's kind of the evolution of what I did. And as time went along, I just tried to make it as simple as I could. I'm just trying to repeat and be consistent with what I'm doing. And I was, you know, if you saw me throw in high school or throw in college, it was a lot less straightforward, I guess. Let's put it that way. My mechanics weren't crazy, but they weren't as simplistic as they were as I got older. So it was just an evolution of pitching and trying to be more consistent and trying to do the same thing over and over again and trying to make it look exactly the same every time, so that the hitter didn't know whether it was, you know, fastball change, slider, curveball, whatever it was going to be. And it just became part of what I did. I must have figured out something pretty good because I played a long time. I never had arm surgery, which is completely lucky and almost unheard of. So I had a lot of things go my way, as far as that goes.
Your curveball was self-taught. And I remember you telling me about the first time you tried it in a game. It was kind of a disaster because it was so sharp that the catcher had trouble with it. What do you remember about that?
Well, that was way back in high school. I threw hard my whole life. So I never really had developed a curveball. I could just throw the ball and throw it by people. And so when I got to high school, it didn't happen that way right away, obviously. So I had to do other things. So I started figuring out a way to throw a curveball. And I had always messed around with knuckleballs because I just thought it was fun to do as a kid. And I figured out that I could throw a knuckleball but make the ball spin too much. Instead of making it not spin, I could make it over the top spin too much. So I just kept working on it and broke it out in a game. The catcher had, it was because sometimes it wouldn't spin quite as much and it would have a little more knuckle to it. And so, but it was really effective. And that's kind of how I started throwing that curveball, through high school and then into college. And the first couple of years I played in pro ball. And then I started working on another curveball that I had learned from a guy in college. And I never got confident enough with it till I was a couple of years into pro ball. So it's kind of an evolution of things and a transition from a curveball that I had was self-taught as a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old, until I got to one that I threw more, you know, maybe 10 years later, a curveball that I had learned in college that I finally got enough confidence with and figured out how to throw and then used that one for the probably most of the remainder of my career.
Moose, in 2001, before that World Series, you were on the field for, you know, what'll go down in history as the Jeter flip play. Give a listen to this.
Doesn't have a stolen base the entire season, so you're not going to run. You're not going to hit and run. You got to wait for a gapper.
That is fair down the right field line. Giambi on his way to third, and they're going to wave him around. The throw misses a cutoff man. Shot into the plate. Out of the plate. Derek Jeter with one of the most unbelievable plays you will ever see by a shortstop. Both cutoff men were missed. Jeter coming down the line, fielded with his bare hand, a shovel to Posada, and Giambi is out. What an unbelievable play by Jeter.
Now, Moose, I think one thing that people forget is how fragile you guys were in that moment. You're down to Oakland in the division series. The offense, it was really struggling early in that postseason. This is before you blew out Seattle, before you played a Game 7 of the World Series. And you are hanging on by a fingernail in that game to a 2-1 lead. What do you remember about that play?
I just remember of all the pitches I threw a cutter that went down and in to a lefty, which is sometimes really bad news, especially if it's not all way off the plate. And it wasn't way off the plate. It was on the plate and he ripped it down the line. I went to back up home. You know, I got my back turned to most of the play until I turn around and the ball's coming in and G grabs it and flips it backhanded. And we make the play at the plate and everybody, you know, it's crazy and all this stuff. And everybody, what was he doing there? You know, he was kind of supposed to be there. He's supposed to be in the middle of the infield and he just kind of followed the flight of the ball. But it was just the way things were going for us. We had lost the first two games at home. We flew all the way to California and we're down 0-2 and we're not scoring a ton of runs and it's later and it's, you know, it's the latter part of the game. And, you know, it's just one of those plays that was, you know, if it happens in August in the middle of a season, you know, it's talked about for one day and then you move on to the next day full of games. And in this situation, it happens in a playoff game. And now we talk about it forever. And it was an awesome play. Unbelievable. And it changed the whole perspective for us. You know, we win that game and then we win the next game and, you know, fly back to New York and win game five. And like you said, we took off from there and make it all the way to game seven of the series. So it was just one of those moments that, you know, has, you know, Derek Jeter and the New York Yankees written all over it. So it's still talked about, you know, almost 20 years later.
When do you remember in your mind's eye this Shane's throw coming in from the outfield? Was there any reaction like, oh, geez, it's not going to be close? Or was there any of that feeling like, no, there's no chance?
Well, when the ball went in the corner with two outs, I mean, I know when he hits it and it goes fair down the line that the guy at first is trying to score. You know, this has to be, and we got to relay it just right because it's not like he's frozen on a line drive or, you know, waiting for the ball to go through. As soon as he hit it, he's gone. So, and it wasn't like I knew he ran well and all this. So, you know, like I said, I was running the back up the play. So when I turned around, the ball was already in the air. And, you know, your first thought is, this is, you know, he's going to score. It's like, I don't even think about that. He's going to score. And it one hops to Derek on the run, and Derek throws it off backhand on the run. And still on the tag, I'm like, you know, he didn't slide. Did he actually tag him? How'd the ball not get kicked out of his glove, tagging him on the leg as he's running by? You know, there's a whole bunch of things that I wasn't really how in the world that all that happened in that one play. And yet it did, and we're in the dugout, and we're still leading, and we still have a chance to somehow win this game.
I've seen still pictures of that play in which Jeremy Giambi's foot is just a fraction of an inch off the plate, and you could see his uniform rippling from Jorge's tag. So I have no doubt that he was out. I mean, have you been asked about that or wondered about that or talked to anybody about that?
Right after it happened, obviously people look at it and go, you know, did you really get him? How, you know, all this stuff. And like, I don't know. I was 50 feet behind home plate and I don't know. And just, it was a blur. And do you remember the umpire? Was it Danley?
Yes, it was Kerwin Danley.
It was Danley. So, and don't ask me how I remember that. I just, it's one of those things that sticks with you, but you know, the blur, it's a blur of a play. It's a one hand tag. And he calls him out, and like, there's no replay back then. So, like I said, and I walk back over to our side to the dugout because I'm backing up on the other side where the throw's coming from. I'm on the other side of home plate. And I'm like, did that really happen? Like, did he just flip that backhand and we swipe tag one-handed with the catcher's mitt and tagged him like on the thigh in between a two legs? Is like, how did he not kick it right out of there? I don't know. And like, did that really just happen? And we're still playing and we got a chance, like, and then, you know, a couple of days later, we're in the next round. So
have you, in all the years you played, did you ever see a shortstop make a play in that area of the field? Cause I never did. Like, it was amazing to me that a shortstop would make a play even in that general area.
Nah, well, like I said, I think he was in the middle of the infield trying to be playing between cut for third and, you know, going to back up the throw from, and ended up being where he was. So I just think the throw was made. Derek was somewhere around the mound and the throw was made. And he obviously saw the flight of the ball and knew it was going to be too high. So he just took off and followed the path of the ball from the middle of the infield where he was. So, and then ended up making a play from there. So, you know, sometimes you just have to go out and make a play. You know, they talk about it all the time in football or in basketball because that kind of action is happening all the time. Baseball, that kind of action doesn't happen, you know, all the time in the game. It happens from time to time in the game. So, you know, it was a situation where he went and made a play, and that's what Hall of Fame people do once in a while.
We recently talked with Aaron Boone about Game 7 of the American League Championship Series in 2003, and he said that one of his memories from that night was seeing you in the clubhouse after the game, and he was so happy for you because you had three scoreless innings of relief to keep the Yankees in it, and that was before Rivera had his three innings of relief. What do you remember about that night?
I mean, obviously you remember that you walk into the manager's office and say, I can give you whatever you need, and we all did. We all, you know, it's game seven. We're like, if you need an out, if you need an inning, you know, I'll give you whatever I can. And so Mel Stottlemyre came to me and say, listen, you know, we're going to send you out to the bullpen a couple innings into the game. And if I need you, I'll put you in fresh to start an inning. I said, okay, that's fine. And so, I'm out there and we're already, when I went out, we were already down a little bit And I get out to the pen, and I wasn't sitting there very long. And Roger gives up a solo home run, I think, to start the inning. And then the phone rings, and they tell me to get up. So, okay, so I start playing catch. And then, like, one pitch later, there's a base hit. And so I'm like, okay, I got to go. And so I'm starting to throw. As soon as I'm getting the ball back, my foot's in the hole. Like, my foot's in the hole on the mound waiting for the ball to come back from the catcher so I can throw again. And then I look out the window, and there's a hit-and-run base hit because you could see through the plexiglass window at the old Yankee Stadium. From the mound I was throwing on, you could see out, and there's a hit-and-run base hit. And now I'm like, it's one curveball. It's one slider. It's one sinker. It's, you know, it's one of everything. I'm just as fast as I can go. It's like I'm warming up in between innings, throwing one of everything, but I'm throwing all out as fast as I can. You know, and I'm a starter. This is not how you get ready when you're a starter. And then the phone rings again, and they get another guy up. Well, they got the other guy up before the hit-and-run base hit. So a lefty got up next to me on the other mound, and so then I'm looking back out, and there's a hit-and-run base hit, and I'm like, oh, so I throw a couple real fast, one or two, and I look out again, and here comes Joe out of the dugout walking to the mound. And I turn around and look, and the other guy warming up isn't even on the rubber yet. He's still playing catch at the bottom of the mound. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm in because this is the second trip this inning. Somebody's going in. And so he points to the pen, and I flipped the ball to somebody. I don't even know who I flipped the ball to, and went out the gate and ran across the field and never been. And I'll tell you the truth, you know, starting pitchers don't run in from the bullpen, okay? Before the game, 15 minutes before the game starts, when we walk in, or 10 minutes, when we walk in, we walk from the pen. And so there was 50,000, however many is in Yankee Stadium. It's 50,000. It could have been 50 million for me because I could feel my heart beating in my throat. And I have to jog from here all the way to the infield and, like, just don't fall down. Just don't look, you know, just get there and then worry about whatever you got to do. So I jogged all the way to, like, the infield grass and then walked from the infield grass to the mound. And I don't even know what anybody said. I don't remember anything. I just remember it's first and third and there's nobody out. And from a starter's mentality, my theory is, okay, well, the guy on third is going to score, you know, 19 times out of 20. I'm going to give up at least one right here. If this is me in an inning that there's first and third, nobody out, I'm saying, okay, the guy on third is going to score. Let's just hold him to one. And that's my mentality. It's always been my mentality for, you know, at the time, for a lot of years, that was what my mentality was. So Veritek was up, and I'd had pretty good success with him over the years. I made a couple good pitches and struck him out with a breaking ball. And then John, and then Damon came up, and I'm still okay. Now, if I could just get a pretty hard ground ball, because Johnny runs really good, so I gotta get something here that if I get a double play ball, it's got to be hit pretty firm, or I gotta get him to pop up or something. Because now I got a chance to get out of this. Like, now I can see the light. There's a chance. And I jam him just enough that he hits kind of a firm one hopper that Derek grabs and steps on second and throws the first one. We get a double play. And so all of a sudden, everybody's like, holy crap. You know, we got a chance here. You know, we're down 4-0, but they didn't score anymore somehow right there. And I think we came right out and scored the next half inning. I think Giambi hit one of his home runs the next half inning. And so now we had a little emotion was on our side, and I got out of another jam an inning later or something with two on and two out, and so I ended up getting through three innings, and we got right back in the game. And I do remember this. I think David Wells came in and pitched an inning behind me, and yep. The first guy up was Poppy, and Poppy hit a homer into the bleachers in right center field. And it went from, I think it was 4-2, to 5-2. I'm like, oh my gosh, we had, you know, there was all the momentum, and in like one pitch, Poppy puts it in the bleachers, and now it's 5-2. So, but then somehow we crawl back into it and get fortunate on a couple soft hits, and then Booney shows up in the 11th inning or 12th inning. I don't even remember anymore. But of course he's up against Wakefield, who he faced in game whatever in Fenway, and I don't think he touched the ball. He struck out three or four times and didn't touch it. And that was I don't know if you remember that part of it, but I do. And I'm like, he's up against Wakefield. Wakefield's in. And first thing he sees is like belt high floater, and he squares it up and hits it in the seats. And that was it. So
I'm looking at the rundown of that game, and your recall is almost perfect. After you got the double play, it was an inning later that Giambi homers off Pedro Martinez.
Okay.
But besides that, you nailed everything, which is pretty amazing all these years later. Where were you when Aaron hit his home run?
I was inside. I was because I had I'd pitched three innings. I'm pretty sure I had ice on because we had a chance to win. You know, our season wasn't coming to an end. You know, so I had the ice because now we might keep playing. So. So I'm pretty sure I was inside and by the time he hit it, I think the ice thing was done. So, I was just sitting in there and probably had just a pullover jacket on or something. So when he hit it, you know, we're flying down the old tunnel down from the clubhouse to the dugout. And we're just sprinting down there to get there when he got the home plate. So, yeah, I know I was inside.
You pitched your entire career in the American League East. And as Jim Palmer, you know, we talked to him the other day. He noted you pitched in the steroid era. And a lot of the years you pitched in Camden Yards, a hitter's haven. Pitcher on that staff once told me that they ran a tape measure out from home plate to left center field where they got that 364 marker, that it was actually closer to 350. How much pride do you take in that?
I didn't see it. Okay. But I heard somebody got a highway measuring wheel, like the
right.
People, they walk down the road from like one end of the guardrail to the other to see how long it is and all that stuff. They had one of those wheels out. So they wheeled it from home plate to left center, right center, all that stuff. And yeah, I heard the story was it said 364 on the wall.
Right.
First of all, on left center field, 364 is a joke, but we felt like it was closer to 346. So they just turned the last two numbers around to make it seem legitimate. But anybody that plays in the major leagues knows that 364 in the gap is not very far. So yeah, the ball flew out of there a lot, especially back at the beginning. It just seemed like it out of there all the time. And now there's a hotel in left center. So I think the wind changed, the air flows a little different, but yeah, the ball flew out of there. And I felt, I'd only played in Baltimore. I mean, I hadn't been anywhere else, but I knew that the ball flew well there. And I gave up my share of homers. I gave up some far ones, you know. I gave up my share of homers in New York, too. So, but it was, to be part of that stadium when it opened and to be part of the sellout crowds every night for I don't know how many years, and to be part of, Ripken's record-breaking game, which actually I just saw on television the other day.
Yep.
I was a lot smarter pitcher, by the way, like 10 years after that. I don't know who that kid was just throwing hard every pitch back in 95, but that's all I did. Apparently all I did was throw like 85 fastballs and two curves. But to make it to the postseason there and win some games and get to the championship series 2 years in a row and I had the opportunity to play with some really good players, some Hall of Famers. It was a great time. My years in Baltimore, I thought were awesome. And I thought my years in New York were awesome too. So
last one for you. I wanted to ask you about, you were part of two of the most memorable fights in baseball history. That fight when you were on the Orioles with the Yankees in 98, but then there was that one with the Mariners in 1993, you hit Bill Hasselman. I remember you telling me when I was covering the team, you're like, you know what? I always regret hitting him, and I would never do that again. And you were, that wasn't your inclination anyway. You didn't like the whole retaliation thing. And the other thing too is that you got hurt from that fight, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I messed up my shoulder a little bit. I just didn't, I guess the situation, it depends what's necessary at the time. If you think people are being thrown at or what, I didn't think that was a circumstance at the time. And we were way up And I didn't like the thought process into, you know, if we were going to send a message, we're not going to get two outs first and then plunk somebody. You know, if we're going to do it, let's do it right. So, but we got two outs first, and then the guy who I'm going to plunk is the guy who hit the solo homer last time around, and to plunk somebody after they hit a homer is really old school and not the right way to do it. Just because the guy hit a homer off me doesn't mean he needs to get hit. So I just didn't feel right about the way we were going about it. But probably if I hit him in the leg instead of in the shoulder, maybe it doesn't happen that way. But that's the way it happened. So we end up in a pretty big fight. And now I end up on the bottom of the pile and probably messed my shoulder up a little bit. And I think Cal got beat up a little bit in it too. We were fortunate that he was still able to play after that. So it wasn't something I'm really proud of, but it happened. I actually ended up talking to Bill. Oh, it was years later. He was coaching or something, bullpen coach for the Red Sox. Years later, I was probably in New York by the time this happened, and they were out on the field taking batting practice, and he was out shagging, and I was walking to the bullpen to throw my bullpen for the day. It was early, and I walked past him, and I said hey to him, and we hadn't spoken in all those years, and I said hey to him, and we talked for a couple minutes, and I kind of gave him the quick story and told him sorry about all that, how it happened. But at least I had never had a chance to talk to him before that. And yeah, that's kind of how it happened. And I wasn't a big fan of it the way it went down, but it's the way it happened.
And I'm guessing, cause Bill's a good guy, I'm guessing he accepted that, probably appreciated it.
Yeah. I think by the time we get done talking, we were in a decent place, and, you know, I'm not sure how he felt about me before that. I had nothing, obviously nothing against him, and I didn't hit him because I was mad at him. I was hitting because they told me to hit him. So, but you know, things happen, and we got through it, and the game goes on, but I'm glad I got to talk to him about it.
I saw a replay of that again over the weekend. Again, I was reminded that your former teammate, Alan Mills, the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. Sunday, he would come in with Sunday dress with a tie, you know, with a tie,
yeah.
And he'd be
yep.
all nice. And then if any fight broke out, he was the scariest person on the field.
Yeah, he, whatever switch goes on or whatever happens when
the
something
incredible
like that
Hulk.
Happens.
The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah,
right?
he goes, he's ready to tear somebody's head off. And, you're right. He goes from one extreme to the other. But I just saw him a couple years ago. We did an Orioles 25 years since the opening of the stadium or something. And I saw him there, and he's the same guy. He's just like, you know, he's always smiling, and it's like you just saw him, you know, last month. And, you know, it's fun to see those guys get a chance to do that. But Millsy's, you know, he was a great teammate, but when the switch goes on, he's a different person.
Moose, it was fun watching you last year at the Hall of Fame. That was really cool. Congratulations on that, and thanks for taking the time for us today.
No problem, Buster. It was good talking to you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Quick batch of Bleacher Tweets today. First up, Brian Simpson at bsimp120274. He writes in, love the interview with Johnny Bench. However, I was hoping you were going to ask him about The Baseball Bunch, a show my brother and I watched every week after This Week in Baseball with Mel Allen. Did you watch those shows back in the 80s? I've never heard of these before, so I'm also interested, like Brian.
Yeah, Brian, when I was doing my research and getting ready to start the interview, the list of questions I have is enormous. And as you go along, we've had such great fun. And hopefully the folks we're interviewing are having fun as well. But, you know, you get to the end of the interview and you have like 10 to 15 questions that you didn't even have a chance to address. That was one of them, by the way. I did not see that because at that time, I was in school and I just, you know, on Saturdays I was doing other stuff. I think I'm a little bit older than you are and I probably didn't have the opportunity, but this week in baseball, I saw that a lot in the 70s. I love that with Mel Allen. That was awesome.
Last one for today. Triple Shy at BB_Ben29 writes in, if the KBO puts dressed up mannequins in the stands to simulate real fans, would you call these fannequins? Asking for a friend. Boom.
Very nice, Triple Shy. Very nice. We really like that one. Good call right there.
That'll do it for Bleacher Tweets. Subscribe, rate, and review to this fine podcast and wherever you get to podcasts. And do we want to tease who we have coming up either at the end of this week, next week? We got him in the hopper.
That's right. We've got Jim Palmer. We're going to run that interview on Wednesday. We're going to be talking with George Brett. We're going to be talking with Randy Johnson. We've got other Hall of Famers in the mix as well. We are loaded up. People are being so generous with their time, helping us out during this time without baseball and helping to distract everybody with their great stories. That's it for today. My thanks to Tim Kirkchin and to Mike Messina for his time from the mountains of Pennsylvania. Have a good day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.